This Week in Retronauts, I Love Thee. Welcome to an episode of Retronauts live and exciting from Japan. You're not listening to this live, but we are recording it live in Japan, in Nagoya, Japan. Actually, is that how you pronounce it? How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, Nagoya.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Oh, who's that?
Oh, hi. I'm Alex Fraioli.
Where would people know you from, Alex?
Oh, dear.
Your nightmares?
Mostly the nightmares.
Open their closet at night.
Waking up screaming. A long time ago, I used to do some freelance work for 1UP, if anyone remembers that.
That's correct.
And then I came to Japan, and I opened a video game bar, and...
That's where we are right now.
That's pretty much, yeah, that's the progression. That's
but people probably know you from your podcast, No More Whoppers.
Oh, that's right.
You co-host with Retronauts regular Ray Barnhold.
A beautiful young boy named Ray Barnhold and I. We do a show called No More Whoppers. It's... Yeah, it's basically just me talking about life in Japan and him talking about life back home, and you know, it's how we deal with our stress.
Is it called No More Whoppers because it's so hard to find a Burger King in Japan?
Yes,
I knew it. I'm not the only person here. You're not the only person here. There's another person here.
Hey, it's Bob Mackey. It's my first time in Japan, and anime is real.
It's true.
Yeah, Geodude, we're friends now.
Yes, we haven't walked across a scramble crossing yet, but I could see the wistful look in Bob's eyes as we pass through Shibuya.
It's embarrassing how many things I know just through video games and anime.
Osmosis. Yeah. You've played Persona. There's no escaping
it.
Yeah, so anyway, we are here at Alex's Bar, Critical Hit, in Nagoya, which everyone who is in Nagoya ever should come visit and drink from, you know, like get a drink at, I guess, and play some video games because, man, there's a lot of video games here.
I have several video softwares.
Yes, your collection dwarves mine. I only have like Game Boy stuff. You have everything. You even have strategy guides. In case someone comes in and gets really drunk and stuck at Final Fantasy X, they're set.
It happens from time to time.
I'm sure. So yeah, we're going to talk this episode, at least in the first half, with Alex about Dragon Quest, because I hear tell Alex likes him some Dragon Quest.
I am a little bit of a fan. It's a fun series.
And this episode is going to be timed to launch around the same time that Dragon Quest XI hits the US. So if you're listening to this now, it's probably September or thereabouts. So hello to the people in the future. I hope the world is okay. Yeah, so, you know, with Dragon Quest XI coming out and the RPG history series that I've been writing for US Gamer, I think an important component of all this is to step back into the dim and distant year of 1986, which sadly I still remember, and talk about the origins of one of the most important video game series of all time. So, Dragon Quest. Where did you guys first encounter Dragon Quest? Or, as we unwashed Americans knew it in our filthy way, Dragon Warrior?
I was in the second grade, I think. I was 7 or 8 or at the time, or however old you are then. And my brother was a freshman in high school, and his friend went on vacation. And he's like, hey, Chris, borrow my NES and all my games. And my brother's like, yes, I will do that. And so, suddenly, we had an NES in our house, and... Imagine like getting all at once Mega Man and Contra and Castlevania and Ninja Gaiden.
That must be nice. They drip fed that to me.
I
was an old person. I was there from the start.
My parents, they would not buy us one. And then we got to borrow one, and included in that trove of games was Dragon Warrior. And it wasn't my first exposure to RPGs, because I had been into Phantasy Star before that, but It's what really hooked me on RPGs, because I had just been used to, you know, action titles up to that point. And a game that I can actually play, you know, leisurely, that was a new thing for me, really, at the time. And Dragon Warrior kind of was the first example of a game that stuck with me for that reason.
Mm. As a second grader, were you alarmed by the volume of text in the game?
Not so much the volume
and
of text.
And the these and the thou.
There we go. Yeah, that's that kind of... As a kid, I'm like, Mom, what are these words? I don't know. I know these letters. I know how they sound, but I don't know what this means.
Right. So how about you, Bob?
I think it was the, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but it was the Nintendo Power deal where you would get a free copy if you subscribed in. Was that in 1989?
No, 89 was when the game came out.
Okay.
So it was probably 1991.
Okay. It might have been 1990, and I think it was the first RPG I'd seen at that point. A neighbor had it, and I believe Nintendo Power was very popular in my neighborhood because it was a very working class town, and the prospect of getting a free video game just for buying a magazine, no one could pass up. So... it was like nothing I'd ever seen before, and I think that's why I was really fascinated with it. I would just go over and watch him play through it, and I was just alarmed, like, you have to read while you play this game? That just struck me as an oddity. But that might have been just what hooked me from the beginning, just how different it was from everything else. But I guess that wasn't the case for what happened sales-wise to Dragon Quest One in America.
Right. Yeah, so as for myself, I was a dutiful little Nintendo Power subscriber, and I already had a subscription to Nintendo Power, and therefore I did not qualify for a free Dragon Warrior. Instead, I asked for it for Christmas 1989 and received it, much to my surprise. And when I first put it in, I wasn't really sure what to think of it, because it was really ugly, the music was kind of shrill, and it was really slow. And I had seen, you know, some RPGs before that, you know, watching other people play stuff like Tunnels and Trolls or whatever. So I wasn't totally alienated by it, but I was really kind of put off by how slow it was. But, you know, it was a Christmas gift, and it's not like I had a huge Steam backlog or something. So I went ahead and played it and kind of got into it and, you know, went through the first quest area and eventually rescued the princess. And that wasn't the end of the game. And that was the point at which I was like, oh, wait. This is really interesting. Like the standard video game quest, you know, to play 5 hours and rescue a princess. Like that's just the start. That's like the first half of the game. There's more to it than that. That's really interesting. So I got hooked on it. And even though I don't think I really got what an RPG was, but I just kept bumbling my way through until I defeated the Dragon Lord. And then I never played another Dragon Quest game again until many years later.
What's interesting to me about that first half of the game is rescuing the princess really is optional. Like, you have to do it to get the whatever the item is, the charm. You get her love and you find the thing in the swamp.
But Waylon's love.
Yes. Mm. But you can go through the whole game without even rescuing her. And you come back at the end with the orb of light and the king's just like, eh, good enough. Like, whatever.
You can also save her from the dragon and then not take her back to the palace. So you're carrying, there's a special sprite when you you rescue the princess and you're like carrying her through the world. You can actually go and defeat the Dragon Lord if you don't save and don't return to Tantagel Castle. And I've seen YouTube videos of people. I'm sure you'd need to either be very lucky, very patient, or use save states. But you can fight the Dragon Lord by carrying Princess Gwailin into the castle.
It's not so hard, because you can do the princess thing at any time. You can just level on up and then get the princess and go to the Dragon Lord. But for me as a kid, the thing that made that funny was as an immature child, if you have the princess and you sleep in an inn, when you wake up, the innkeeper says, "Looks like you had a fun time." Or something
really?
To that effect, yeah.
I did not know that. Oh, that doesn't surprise me, though, because there is an element of sauciness to the Dragon Quest series that is still present to this very day, with their Puff Puffs and your casino bunny girls and so on and so forth.
Yeah, once the early modern English went out the door, all the sleaze came in.
I guess it was an okay trade-off. But that was something that was remarkable about the original Dragon Warrior, was that Nintendo localized it, and they put a lot of effort into it. You didn't really see people trying to construct sensible grammar at that point in video games, let alone give it a, you know, like an embellished sort of Shakespearean-ish Bob, you're the English lit expert, right. So you can be very specific about
this. I
can
shout at everybody. It's not Old English.
Nope.
It's not Middle English. It's Early Modern English, which is what Shakespeare wrote in.
Okay.
But it's not important at all.
Hooray.
I just spend money on student loans every month to yell at people about that. So.
Well, I'm fine. I'm glad this is one of those opportunities where it pays off.
Are you, 3 times a year.
Do you think Dragon Warrior should have been in iambic pentameter?
No.
Good.
No, I mean, they've done that with some of the more recent localizations where you see buffed up text, like for certain characters in certain towns.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's... So, there's a town in Dragon Quest XI that I've seen where it's like a Japanesque type town, and everyone speaks in haiku. So,
that's pretty clever. As long as it doesn't get in the way of communication.
No, it's actually, from what I've seen, it's actually accurate haiku in that there is a lot of nature imagery in it,
okay.
Which
that's cool.
Proper haiku uses.
Because I was just playing Dragon Quest IV on my phone on the way over here, and the Scottish accents are just miserable. You have to read the dialogue out loud in your head to know what anyone's saying.
Yeah, so, I mean,
they took it too far, but they pulled back.
Yeah, they went overboard with Dragon Quest IV, and I think once they got feedback from users who were like, what did you do? I don't understand anything. They dialed it down. So more recent games have lots of dialects to, you know, reflect the dialects in the Japanese, but they don't get in the way so much anymore. And that's good. Let's talk a little bit about the origins of Dragon Quest, because, you know, we are starting here a series of deep dives into the Dragon Quest series, so we might as well kind of lay the groundwork. And the groundwork starts, I don't know, where do you think the groundwork starts?
I remember Enix at the time, I think, I don't know if they were working for Enix at the time, but Yuji Horii and Koichi Nakamura. And Yuki Nobu Chida, is that the guy?
Yeah.
They won a contest, I believe.
So I think they won individual contests at the time. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go back to the dim and even more distant year of 1983-ish, 82. Enix is not a developer. Enix has always been a publisher, and they, kind of got their start in gaming on PCs, and they would, you know, take promising young developers and basically fund their games. And so after a while, they started doing these contests where you could submit games to Enix. And like they would judge them, and then the winners would get their game published and apparently get a lot of money. And one of the winners of one of their contests was a guy named Koichi Nakamura. And he created a little platformer game called Door Door. And it won and became a pretty big hit on Japanese PCs. And it got ported to a bunch of other systems like Famicom. And I think he got pretty wealthy off of it. And so he started his own studio called Chunsoft, which is named for the character that started in Door Door, Chun. And that was one contest. And then the other contest was, like you said, Yuji Horii and Chida. Can't remember his full name.
Yuki Nobu
Chida. And they created a game called... forget it. It's the Portobia Serial Murder Case.
Wait, I thought Yuji Horii made a tennis game first. That was the first contest he won. Something called like Love Match.
Oh, was it?
Or something like that. Yeah.
That sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when I did a episode a long time ago about this, I remember reading the history of that. That it was his first like contest win for Enix,
okay.
And that's how he got into the game.
Got it. So they established their own studio, whose name I don't actually know. His studio now is called Armor Project, but yeah. I don't know if that's what it was at the time. Okay, so you're right. Yeah, I did forget about that. But yeah, he created the tennis game, and then they built their adventure game. And the adventure game was the big deal because it was kind of the start of a pretty popular genre in Japan, the graphical adventure, like their take on it. And you know, it was pretty much a standard PC graphical adventure with a little windowed image in it, and then kind of like a menu to work through. But I kind of feel like the revolution there was when they brought the game to Famicom,
mm-hmm.
and they had to make it work. And if you've read the book I Am Error by Nathan Eltis, there's an entire chapter dedicated to like this, or not an entire chapter, but a big chunk of text dedicated to this game that never came to the US. and about how complicated it was to take a PC graphical adventure and turn it into a Famicom game, especially that early on, you know, before you had expanded memory, because, you know, the way graphics worked on NES Famicom was they had to be tiled, so they couldn't just like draw a house. They had to create the individual tiles of a house. They had to create like the tiles for the borders of the window and that sort of thing. So it really forced them to kind of rethink how everything worked. Also, they were no longer able to have people play games on a keyboard, on a computer. They had to control everything with two buttons and a D-pad. So that forced them to rethink the interface. And the game was a big hit. And I feel like that really laid the groundwork for Dragon Quest. Anyway, I've been talking a lot, so you guys can take over.
No, I feel like this could be, I don't know, an exaggeration, but I feel like in a way he's sort of a Will Wright-esque figure, and the fact that he created two very strong genres while drawing from earlier ideas. But the Japanese graphic adventure game, that still lives on in things like Ace Attorney and Danganronpa and other things like that. And obviously the console Japanese RPG still follows many of the traditions that Dragon Quest set out, especially Pokemon, which is huge still. It's never not been huge.
Right. And Dragon Quest itself is still very much Dragon Quest. It has not changed. But yeah, Dragon Quest was a big breakout in Japan. And I feel like the design of the game was built really heavily around what they did with Portopia. Like it's basically combining a role-playing game with, you know, like an Ultima-style role-playing game with the graphical adventure window format. But that was like the combat window. And that's kind of a big deal, because if you look at RPGs that came before that, they were either, you know, stuff like Falcom's games, which were very sort of janky and real-time. And then you had stuff like Wizardry, which was a huge influence on them. And everything was windowed and kind of ugly. And Dragon Quest had a much nicer visual style, and it just felt more immersive. It did a good job of combining a lot of different things.
Where does the Black Onyx fit into all of this?
The Black Onyx, I think, was 1984.
Yeah.
And that was Hank Rogers, a Dutch guy who came to Japan and was like, people here seem to like importing Wizardry. I should make a game like Wizardry in Japanese, even though I don't speak Japanese. And he did. And it was a pretty big hit. And yeah, Yuji Horii and Koichi Nakamura both were pretty big Wizardry fans and Ultima fans also. But supposedly they went to an Apple Expo, Macworld or whatever. I guess it was before Macintosh. And saw Wizardry in action and were like, yes, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. So they got really hooked on that and stuff like Black Onyx and decided to sort of recompile the genre in their own image, and the result was Dragon Quest. Yeah, so I've been talking a lot, so I'll let someone else take over. Yeah,
I just didn't want to neglect the Black Onyx, because I feel like I just popped in my head, and I often feel with all of our shows, when we try to do like a fossil record of genres and things like that, it's often who does it best instead of who did it first.
Right.
And Dragon Quest really did do it best.
Oh yeah, yeah, it definitely wasn't the first of anything to speak of,
but it was the most like evocative of what it was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a big part of Dragon Quest's success came down to Akira Toriyama, a famous and beloved comics artist, mangaka in Japan, who at the time was, had he just started Dragon Ball?
I think that was
86-ish.
Dragon Ball was already underway at the time.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so he had a big hit with Dr. Slump, which mm-hmm. you're a big fan of.
Oh, yeah.
And then Dragon Ball started, and that was a pretty big hit. So I don't remember exactly how they hooked up. I know Koichi Sugiyama, the composer, like wrote in and said, I like your video games. Can I write music for you?
I think he filled out a questionnaire that came with, a Mahjong game. And yeah. And at the time, like just a quick dive into Sugiyama's deal. He was already like, he had already had a career at that point. He did music. He wrote pop songs. He scored Godzilla films. Mm. Like he was in his 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He was more or less retired. And then they're like, no, you know what? Do more music for us. He's like, okay.
Yeah. It would be like if Danny Elfman today wrote to someone and was like, hey, I want to write music for your video game. Like to, you know, to an indie artist or something. It was like, let's do that.
That'd be pretty great.
I mean, actually, I think Trent Reznor is a huge fan of Pixel Junk Monsters. So he's he texts Dylan Cuthbert occasionally. I saw Dylan's phone when I was interviewing him, and he was like, "Yeah, check that out." There's Trent Reznor, just like, "Hey, what's up?"
It's amazing.
So I guess that kind of thing happens.
Yeah.
You know, people play video games. I guess even more so now than it used to be. But I still don't know how Toriyama got involved, I guess.
I was curious, was there an existing relationship between Enix and Shonen Jump where Toriyama was being published?
I think that's how it got connected. Yeah. And that was definitely how Dragon Quest became big, because when it first launched, it was kind of like, it did okay, but it was one of the, like Pokemon, it didn't really take off immediately because it wasn't obvious what it did well and what was so cool about it, but word of mouth kind of took off, and then Shonen Jump started promoting it in the magazine, and they were like, "Hey, here's a game. You love this Dragon Ball? Well, check it out. This is Dragon Quest. It's kind of like Dragon Ball, but with a quest instead of a ball. Same guy, same dragons. It's cool.
There is a ball, though.
There is a ball, the Orb of Light, but it is not a Dragon Ball.
Okay, that's true.
And the dragons do not grant wishes unless your wish is to die.
No, they just want to wreck you.
Yeah. This may sound stupid, but I have to wonder, of course, it's an RPG. There are dragons in RPGs, but I wonder if that was intentional. Like, oh, yes, Dragon Ball, but what about Dragon Quest? Toriyama connection.
I would not be surprised.
Yeah.
To me, the biggest visual difference is that Dragon Ball is more focused on like a Chinese-style dragon, and Dragon Warrior is much more like the European Western-style dragon.
Yeah. Well, the monsters... The monsters in Dragon Ball look like they're from Dr. Slump, where they're just crazy creatures.
Yeah, those kind of go away after a while in the manga. Like, once you get away from Young Goku's era, you stop seeing, like, the giant dinosaurs and stuff, and it's just more like, hey, here's a really puny alien from space that's going to get big and wreck everyone.
You'll see that in TQ11 when you play that soon. One of the things I love more than anything else is two things: Toriyama dinosaurs and Toriyama robots.
What about Toriyama vehicles?
It just seems cramped, man. I don't know.
There was a great figure that we saw was of Bulma and Young Goku in the little capsule car.
Yeah, I like that figure a lot more than the Bulma figures where she's like incredibly voluptuous. Like, what are you doing? No.
That's not in the source material.
No.
Not until later.
So I don't know if you remember this. The last time I was on your fantastic program, it was TGS like 9 years ago. It was a long time ago.
Sweet God Almighty.
And
was that the Sega Genesis episode?
I think it might have been.
Man, that's been 10 years.
You still haven't done a Sword of Vermillion episode?
Not yet.
Okay. Is
that what we should have done here?
Yes. No, I like both. I mentioned that Akira Toriyama lives, he's like 10 minutes north of here in a little town called Kyosu. And at the time, you could go to his house and you could ring the doorbell. And his elderly mother would come to the door, come to the gate, and you would hand a thing to her, and she would take it inside, and he would sign it, and she would shuffle on out and give it back to you. That no longer happens.
I'm sure people abuse that.
Yeah. But I do have a Toriyama update, if anyone is
I want to hear
interested.
This is a Toriyama news flash.
So, he lives in this town called Kyosu. It's a tiny town that is famous for literally nothing else other than him.
He's the guy who lives in a castle, right?
More or less.
Okay.
Yeah. He does have a gigantic house, and he keeps threatening to move away. And the local government just keeps cutting his taxes until he stays. And they've done this so many times, he basically pays no tax to the Kyosu municipal government. That's a tip for anybody. If you get big enough, try that power move.
Worked for the president. Once Shonen Jump magazine, a comic magazine that comes out here weekly, started promoting Dragon Quest, it got really big. And by the time Dragon Quest 3 came out, it was a phenomenon. And you've heard all the lies about the government stepping in and taking action. Like I said, they're lies. But, it was a cultural phenomenon. And it's never really gone away. I don't know how well 11 sold here, but I feel like it did pretty well.
It sold very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, considering the general health of the console industry in Japan right now, it did. Was that like the best-selling game of besides Monster Hunter or something?
Yeah.
2017?
I would think so. I don't pay attention anymore to numbers so much. I just, whenever I go game shopping, like game shops always have the top 20 ranking of games. And I remember Dragon Quest XI stayed at number one for a very long time.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it definitely kind of reaches back toward the Dragon Quest VIII style. And that, I think, you know, is a natural through line from Dragon Quest I. Whereas some of the more recent games, like 10 was an MMO, 9 was almost an MMO. It was like a baby MMO, like a local MMO. It was very Monster Hunter-ish. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like it's kind of gone back to those classic console roots. And that is, you know, that's what the original Dragon Quest defined.
People get angry when you mess with that, like we saw with when they unveiled 9 originally. Mm-hmm. It was more of like an action RPG,
yeah.
And fans are just like, no, you're not doing that.
Right.
Square's like, yeah, sorry, our bad.
I'm pretty sure they just turned that into Fantasy Life. They said, we'll make our own Dragon Quest with fishing.
Pretty much.
And baking.
In fact, forget the hookers.
Would you say, so Dragon Quest always changes with the times, would you say that 11 is the game that is best suited for 2017 or 2018? In terms of what an audience wants, in terms of, because obviously 10 was built upon the foundation of, you know, the WoW era, World of Warcraft, and right. 9 was both Monster Hunter and the DS phenomenon.
I think Dragon Quest is reflects the times in its own way. So if it really were, you know, the game that everyone wanted now.
Battle Royale?
Yeah, it would be Battle Royale.
But that'd instead, be great if you're all slimes.
Yeah. I'm sure there will be a Dragon Quest Battle Royale game, but it won't. They won't do that in the main line. Like that's, you know, they've gotten really good about using the spinoffs to experiment. So you have your action RPG and Dragon Quest Heroes, which is, you know, a Musou game, but it has a lot of like a strong RPG feel to it that feels authentic to Dragon Quest, and you know, the Minecraft clone in Dragon Quest Builders.
Oh,
and
I
so
like
forth.
That one.
It's a great game.
Yeah, I was kidding, but they did make a Minecraft. Game, yeah, so yeah. Who knows?
But I feel like Dragon Quest XI is it's responding to the people who wanted Ni No Kuni 2 to be good.
Okay,
and they were like, "We can do that."
Misguided.
that one kind of hurts because Ni No Kuni 2 is by people who made Dragon Quest games that were very good, like Dragon Quest VIII, and Dragon Quest XI is someone else doing their shtick better than they do now.
The thing about DQ11 is like as Bob mentioned, like. It having a place in 2017, 2018. I work in this bar and I see people come in who play Dragon Quest XI. Maybe they don't have a PS4. They want to play it. There's a very nice young woman who comes in. She's been plugging away at the game for like a couple of months and she's almost finished with it.
On 3DS?
On PS4.
Oh, okay.
But there is a visceral response from like some young, like I get a lot of young people in here as well, like 20 to early mid 20s. And there's like, The modern young gamer is not okay with a traditional RPG sometimes. I've had people express outrage, like, where's the voice acting? How come there's no voice acting? What's with this MIDI music? Like, that's, you don't get it. Like, and then I have to explain what Dragon Quest is to them. Like, the whole point is it's supposed to be traditional. It's supposed to, it's, you know, carrying on this tradition.
Right. Well, I mean, it's kind of stuck in a funny place because you have tradition, but you also have the need to, like, grow the audience.
They are riding that line. I feel very, I don't know, it seems precarious, but I mean, it's still selling well, so I don't think people mind too much.
Yeah. But you know, Japan is aging, so those old people won't be around forever. And then what happens? I guess there's not any young people to take over, so that's the whole problem.
End of that country.
Yeah.
Yikes. Pretty good run.
So anyway, back to the original Dragon Quest. Why don't we talk a little bit about the design of it and kind of, you know, what it was. I've talked a lot, so someone else do that.
Well, I mean, the original idea was that, I forget the metaphor that Hori used, but it was a game that anyone could finish as long as you sort of played it long enough, because no matter how, I mean, once you play enough, you will naturally, like, mathematically be strong enough to go wherever you need to go and do right. whatever you need to do.
Yeah, well, it's important to clarify in the sense that when you die in Dragon Quest, you lose half of your gold that you have on hand, but you don't lose any experience. So if you keep throwing yourself at the Dragon Lord over and over again, you'll eventually keep leveling up and hopefully eventually get enough money to buy some better armor, like buy the top end stuff. There's not a lot of gear to buy in the game.
And games were much more punishing before that in terms of death, especially RPGs.
Yeah, yeah. And that was kind of, I think that was a big deal. Like, that was a big step toward making Dragon Quest accessible, was the fact that, oh, I lost to the Dragon Lord, but I did gain a level, this foray into his castle, so I can keep going, and every time I go into the castle, I'll beat more of those horrible things that are trying to kill me. Like, there's, like, blue dragons just hanging out in his castle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you fight enough of those, you're going to level up, and eventually you level up enough, and you'll have enough spells that you can stop the Dragon Lord.
I think also losing that gold will also encourage the player to say, oh, I need to get some of this back and fight monsters and maybe buy another weapon, so they right. are naturally encouraged to level up more.
And with it that also punishment. Encourages them to spend, mm-hmm. like, instead of just hoarding gold, to say, oh, well, I have enough to buy a better sword, so I should probably do that now in case I get completely spanked.
Especially, I think they introduced the concept of the gold vault in 3. So 1 and 2, it's that you have to spend it or you risk losing it. And I think the fact that you do keep experience when you die is what appealed to me as a kid. It's like, I didn't, like, as a second grader, I don't have a concept of a developer respecting my time, but that's what it was. It's like, you played for a while, you died, you can keep the experience, it's fine.
And that's a big step away from something like Wizardry, because Wizardry was infamously punishing. And I'm pretty sure the Robert Woodhead interview episode will have gone up by now, but the first two Wizardry sequels required you to play through the preceding games, and all of them were really hard, but you needed to like build on from that. And when you lost, that was it. You had to go back to your save file, back to town. So each foray into the dungeon was extremely dangerous. You'd go further in every time and take bigger risks. So yeah, like it was a game that you did not beat in a weekend, because it was just too hard, too punishing, and there was no forgiveness. But Dragon Quest, you might be able to beat that in a weekend, because, you know, if you had, like, you know, 12 hours free, 15, that's enough time to beat this compact little game, and you lose a few times and it's okay. Pat you on the back and mm-hmm. takes away half your money and, you know, sends you along your way to fight the Dragon Lord again.
It's super playable on phones. I don't play a lot of RPGs on phones. I usually play games designed for phones, but they've made it very, I don't know, even more accessible in terms of, you know, how you move around, what you can do. So, I mean, if you have like a week of commutes, you could probably get through Dragon Quest 1 mm. on the train or on the bus or whatever really easily.
Yeah, I brought along Game Boy Advance here and a copy of Dragon Warrior 1 and 2.
Mm. That's so good.
And yeah, those are good.
It's a really good port because it's based on the Super NES remake. The one thing I don't like about it is that the viewpoint is really zoomed in.
Yeah.
Because of the scaling. They didn't change the size of the sprites. So you kind of need to know where you're going, because it's really easy to get lost. But that's like the one complaint I have.
It's the movement speed is a little slow for me. They fixed that in 3 on the Game Boy Color. But the first one you kind of plod along, but it's not a huge game anyway, so it's not a big deal. Mm.
And Dragon Quest 1, 2, and 3 are a trilogy. They really kind of stepped away from the trilogy concept after that. I've heard Dragon Quest XI really kind of reaches back to the olden days.
There are some loose ties to the original trilogy, but nothing. I think they've kind of everything is self-contained now. They've kind of given up on tying them together.
I think they realized that, oh, there are going to be 3 or 4 or maybe 5 years between these games now, so let's not do this anymore.
Yeah,
what was it, like 18 months between 1 and 2? Something even shorter.
It was like a year.
Yeah,
and then 18 months, like when Chunsoft was doing the programming, we mentioned Koichi Nakamura and Chunsoft earlier, but the first 5 Dragon Quest games were developed, like they were programmed by Chunsoft, and Nakamura, you know, was like the main guy. He's now the president of Spike Chunsoft. Like they did the development, and then after 5, it switched to Heartbeat.
I'm not a fan of their games.
No, they're very drawn out.
Yeah.
I hear 6 is really great on Super Famicom.
It makes me wonder how much input the, I guess, contractor developer has on those games, because I feel like they have a very specific stamp on those 2 games that I do not like, and I've spent so much time with those games.
It's really hard to say, because like the fiction they present is that Yuji Horii is like, you know, everything emerges like Athena from his skull. Yeah. They stick a hammer in his skull or an axe in his skull, and the game springs out fully born. But I don't know. I really liked Chunsoft's games, because I feel like they built on each other in a really great and cohesive way, culminating in 5. And then, you know, they shifted over to make the Mystery Dungeon series, and that started out as Dragon Quest, like a Dragon Quest roguelike, the first Dragon Quest spinoff, really, and became like its own standalone series starring its own protagonist, Shirin.
I will say there's somebody at Enix, it might be Hori, that has the power to make level 5 RPGs good. like very good, because I've played so many level 5 RPGs and there's just something there that someone should have said get rid of that, and I don't see that in Dragon Quest 8 and 9.
Yeah, the level 5 Dragon Quests are spectacular. They're excellent games, and I agree, like every other level 5 RPG I've played except Fantasy Life, I'm just like
yeah, Fantasy Life is pretty good.
And if you treat Fantasy Life as like a failed Dragon Quest 9, then there you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting because there clearly is a singular vision behind the series, and Hori is still extremely involved. Like, he's not, you know, single-handedly making the games, but he really supervises the story and the world development and so forth. And at the same time, you definitely can see the input of the developers who are contracting on the games. So it seems collaborative, and I think it helps keep the franchise fresh. Like, Dragon Quest XI is very much like Dragon Quest VIII, but it's also different. Like,
but it's also internally Square Enix developed.
Yeah.
But
did
yeah.
Do you know if like who from Square Enix helped out with that?
I'm not sure,
because I know Kazuya Nino directed Dragon Quest Builders, the guy who created Trauma Center and Etrian Odyssey.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he was the director on Builders. But I don't know if he had any involvement with 11.
The director is Takeshi Uchikawa, and I don't recognize that name.
Nor do I. Yeah, it is very much collaborative, and it's kind of weird because the game seems so conservative. It always kind of makes me wonder, like, why do these games take so long to put together? But they do have a lot of text.
I think it's also just that it's that Japanese the perfection of simplicity. It's very much a Japanese aesthetic. And when people ask me, like, what's the appeal of Dragon Quest? Why do you like it so much? Why is it, you know, why do you like it better than Final Fantasy? I always point to I think a couple years ago, Tim Rogers did a video about why Dragon Quest is such a phenomenon in Japan. And the example he used is like Final Fantasy is like, what if Lord of the Rings had motorcycles? And Dragon Quest is like, what if fairy tales were really good? Because that's what it's that simplicity. And when Dragon Quest XI was in development, I remember Square Enix put out, they put out a call for scenario writers. And the application was write a fairy tale. Like, come up with something simple, but that is engaging and is like fantastical.
Yeah, a lot of the Dragon Quest games really take that approach. You didn't get that in the early games so much, but basically your journey is a series of vignettes. I think you really saw that especially in the Heartbeat games and in Dragon Quest IX, where you go to a place and it's sort of like a self-contained story. And there is, like, sometimes there's a very happy outcome and sometimes there's not. And you go into these stories sometimes thinking, like, you know how it's going to turn out. And maybe you kind of predict some of the general shape of the plot, but you never know. Like, is this going to be a happy outcome? Or is this going to be where you go away thinking, oh, that was really sad?
I would say maybe with 3, that was very implicit, but with 4, it was explicit in terms of the episodic storytelling.
Yeah.
But 2, it was like, find these two people, collect these things, and then kill the guy.
Make this person not a dog anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. But you don't really realize who you are in 3 until the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do like that sort of vignette-based story approach. I think it works well because it doesn't arrest the momentum of the game, but at the same time, it doesn't make you feel like it doesn't make the overall story hard to follow. There's kind of this overall plot, and you're moving toward it, and you'll get like little connections to the overall plot within the vignette. But 10 hours, 5 hours, and you've wrapped up one little storyline, and it's, you know, it's part of your background.
I feel like 7 and to an extent Dragon Quest 10 did that really well, because those games are pretty much all vignettes. And that's why, like, to the point where, and this applies to the series overall, I think, the last boss of every game is almost, like, it's almost a throwaway boss. Like, it doesn't matter. Here's another giant thing with, like, horns coming out of his knees again. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's the journey is the real reward. That's what I take
the friends
out.
We made along the way.
Yes, you were Dragon Quest slimes, the whole time.
The slimes we killed along the
just
way.
Just some generic. I mean, cool looking boss, but it's just though. It's kind of like the devil or Satan, and just like he's the source of all evil, and the monsters follow his orders. And if there's something going wrong, it's his problem. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you're just fighting the devil in every game, almost
right.
Like our manifestation of the devil.
Yeah, and I think 9 really kind of leaned into that with the post game
yes.
stuff, where it's just like go into a dungeon and fight your favorite boss from a previous game, and it's going to be vastly stronger than you. So go find some metal slimes. That's something worth mentioning too, is just the iconography that Dragon Quest introduced. Like it got so much right out of the gate. You can really see, you know, like elements of those early games, the original game in the current games in a way that you cannot in something like Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
Like the of climbing stairs or the spell sound effects or level up sound effects. Like they still use the Famicom sounds, but it's more than that. Like there are enemies, the little happy slimes, the Drakeys and the Wyverns and even the way dragons look. Like, those have been rendered in 3D now, but they're still those original Toriyama designs, and they don't look dated. They don't look like, oh, these are drawings that are 30 years old. They're still just like, these are fun, charismatic takes on classic RPG monsters. They're just great Toriyama designs.
It's really good for merchandising, too, because if you want to say, I want to buy a Chocobo, oh, these are the ones from 13. I don't like these. I want to buy the ones from 5 or 6 or whatever, but like you said, the consistency is great. As much as I like to see different interpretations of like Shiva and Ifrit, it's also very comforting to see like your old friends that
haven't
changed.
Eventually those Final Fantasy summons, they go in some weird directions, like lesbian Shivas that turn into a motorcycle. I'm like, there's some fetish pandering going on here, and I don't even know what it is, but I'm very confused, and I don't think this is good.
I mean, maybe if the whole game was about that, sure.
Yeah, like, you know, just embrace that as they embrace each other, but...
I agree.
Yeah, I don't know. Final Fantasy goes in some weird directions, but I guess that's kind of the 1-2 punch for Square Enix, is that they have your comfort food in Dragon Quest, and they have just like, here it goes. No one knows what the hell this is going to be. It's crazy Final Fantasy. Oh, it's an action game now. Yeah. Oh, it's Uncharted.
I'm just glad that there have been no more dead zones in terms of Dragon Quest releases. I feel like they're just releasing everything now, because after 8, it was just like, well, we give up.
Yeah, there was a while in the US that it looked like they were going to cut it off at the knees, but... they brought over Builders and Heroes 2 and now 11. So I feel like they're not bringing over everything, but they're bringing over the ones that they're at least taking a chance on the big ones.
I understand why 10 didn't come over here.
Oh yeah, I'm disappointed, because it's the one MMO that I probably would have played. But yeah, you can't even play it through VPN, and I've tried.
I played it for a couple of years. It is really good. It's solid. It feels like story wise, it feels like an offline Dragon Quest. And guess what? In an MMO, if everyone's a Dragon Quest fan, everyone's pretty nice. They're all polite.
Yeah.
No one's a jerk.
I can see that. Yeah. I can see that. All right. So I think we need to wind up, because your bar is about to open and people are going to come in and they're going to scream at us. That's right. Who are these nerds in here? Get them out.
There shouldn't be nerds in this video game bar.
So this will be the end of our conversation on Dragon Quest 1, but hopefully we can continue this podcast episode with some other conversation on Dragon Quest 2 with other cool people. So if not, then that's the end of this episode. But if so, great. Look forward to the second half in a few minutes. In the meantime, Alex, tell us about yourself. Promote yourself.
All right.
I mean, you kind of did it at the beginning, but do it some more.
I'm a vigorous young go-getter. if you live in Nagoya, or if you're visiting Japan, come on down, visit Critical Hit right off the Beltline. You can check us out on Twitter at Critical Hit Bar, or on Facebook.com/Critical Hit Bar. I'm on Twitter as Pitui, that's Pitohui, and check out my and Ray, is it Ray Barnhold?
It is Ray Barnhold.
Ray Barnhold.
That's how you say his name.
I think Raymond, if you want to be formal.
Raymond David Barnhold and I, we do a show called No More Whoppers. Please check it out. Don't start from the beginning.
What happens at the beginning?
It's awful.
Oh, okay. I like those rough starts, though. Yeah, I don't think we need to introduce ourselves.
Yeah, it's fine. You know who I am.
We're going to do a second half.
It's cool.
So... we'll just roll right into Dragon Quest 2 with a mystery guest whose name will be announced after this musical break and advertisement. And when I say back, I mean back from Japan. We're no longer in Nagoya with Alex Fraioli at his bar Critical Hit, but instead back in the comfort. Would you call it comfort, Bob? The comfort of the Retronaut studio.
It's a type of comfort.
It is familiar. It's
yeah.
Wait, who is that on the – what the hell? There's a voice. It's a ghost.
Mysterious voice.
Are you the ghost of the bank vault that we record in?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. How does it smell over there? I've been to one podcast studio and it smelled pretty bad, but it was a lot of fun. There was a lot of camaraderie.
It smells okay when we first get here, but there's no ventilation and no air conditioning. And downtown San Francisco, unlike the rest of the city, gets pretty warm. So it could be kind of rank by the end of the recording session. I know Ron Gilbert was very offended when he came.
He was?
he was like, yeah, we apologize for the smell. He was
like, remember
yeah.
That. Boy, he's still in good terms with me, though.
Okay, that's good. He didn't hold you personally accountable for the stench. But who the hell is this? Who are you, ghost of the bank vault voice, whatever?
I am actually a corporal person. I am Nadia Oxford. I kind of know people. I kind of know you, I guess. I guess we've been friends for a long time.
Kind of? Jeez, come on.
Yeah, we've been friends for a very long time.
We've been working together for years.
Very, very long. Before the internet was even the internet, practically.
Yeah, was Nadia a – I'll give Nadia's biography, by the way. Not Nadia. I have a question, though. Nadia, were you – did you first work with Jeremy in like the early 2000s at 1UP, or was there something before that?
Oh, gosh. I think even before 1UP, he had a zine that I wrote for.
Oh, we were both on the zine.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So
I couldn't remember. That's why I wanted to ask.
My empire has so many tendrils. It's crazy.
You created these monsters, Jeremy.
It's true. But yeah, like I've known Nadia on the internet for ages and ages. And one of the things I know about Nadia is that she really loves Dragon Quest. In fact, her Skype avatar
is looking at it now.
The Saber Cat from Dragon Quest V. I'm afraid we're not talking about Dragon Quest V right now. That's the best Dragon Quest.
Ooh.
We're talking about the worst Dragon Quest, in my opinion, and that's Dragon Quest II. But you got to get through two.
No, 7 is the worst, Jeremy.
No. I know 7 drags on.
It hurt me.
I realize, and I have not subjected myself to the whole thing, but it's a different kind of pain than Dragon Quest II. Dragon Quest II.
Yeah.
Dragon Quest VII is like the guest that overstays its welcome, and you're kind of like, you can leave now. Maybe like last week actually would have been good.
Mm-hmm.
But Dragon Quest II just comes into your house and like, you know, it's basically the thugs from the beginning of The Big Lebowski. It pees on your rug and puts your head in the toilet.
My metaphor or analogy, I'm not sure which one it is. Is it an analogy or a metaphor?
I think
analogy.
Okay, my analogy is whatever.
Let's fight about this.
I have a master's degree. I don't know. Dragon Quest II is like a beating, and Dragon Quest VII is a lingering terminal illness that will eventually kill you.
Okay.
My analogy is that Dragon Quest II – I actually like Dragon Quest VII, so I'm going to leave it alone. But Dragon Quest II was like kind of like when I was a kid, I would have – sitting in bed crying because it had growing pains that hurt so bad, but I knew they were necessary.
Hmm. I do want to hear at some point during this podcast, I know Nadia went to Japan recently and did like the Dragon Quest experience. I saw a ton of pictures from you.
She got into a party and killed slime. It was amazing.
This is slightly off topic, but they have a Dragon Quest VR experience in Japan.
I assume that's kind of like the Dragon Quest arcade game, something along those lines.
It's sort of like the modern, super enhanced version of Dragon Quest Swords or whatever that game was called.
The arcade game was really similar to that.
That's
too,
the one thing I couldn't do when I was in Japan, and maybe next time. But it's like you pay a lot of money to just be in a VR Dragon Quest experience. But man.
I would do that and probably barf everywhere, but it'd be worth it.
Okay, so Dragon Quest II is the Dragon Quest game I have played the least of all the
Same.
Numbered games, besides 10. I thought you had beaten Dragon Quest II, Nadia.
A long, long time ago, but it's not one of the ones I go back to.
Right. Well, why would you? So I guess we should talk about why we're being so mean to this game. And I think it's easiest just to say it's because the game is mean to us.
Mm.
Like Dragon Quest II is, you know, hard in the very old school video game kind of way and kind of misbalanced because it's a very ambitious game and the creators kind of tripped over their own feet. In fact, there's an anecdote that I read online that when they initially playtested the game, they had created like this kind of system to make sure that enemy encounters were going to be on par with your party at that point in the game, but they didn't account for large groups of enemies. So it was actually like impossible to win, and they actually had to go in and add some code to the game to prevent certain late game enemy groups from being more than three at a time. Otherwise, the game was unwinnable. So That is the kind of game that we're dealing with here.
Do you feel like their intent was similar to Nintendo's intent with the second Mario Brothers game, in that you played the first one, now here's a hard, much harder experience because you're ready now for this?
There might be a little bit of that in there, but I really didn't get that impression.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it was really – oh, go ahead, Nadia. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say it just seems to me like they wanted to do everything, of course, bigger and better. And you can see it right there in the game itself when they send you back to Aleph Garden. It's it's a much smaller clone of what you go through in Dragon Quest One. But just like the fact that it was there and the world itself was something like four times bigger than the original game. And when I heard about this, it just blew my tiny little mind, because to me, the original Dragon Quest was like bigger than Eurasia. So mm-hmm. It was like, wow, four times bigger. Oh, my God. And Aleph Garden is there. Wow.
Yeah, Dragon Quest One was really kind of like baby steps into role-playing, and mm-hmm. I feel like this was where they really wanted to make a proper RPG in more of the computer RPG-style mold. And they definitely looked to wizardry for Dragon Quest Two, and that had been a big inspiration for the first game. That was mm-hmm. like what got Yuji Horii and everyone interested in RPGs. But with this game, they were like, well, you know, wizardry does all these things, and we should do that too. Well, wizardry is notoriously vicious. Like, it is a brutally hard mm-hmm. game. And, you know, the creators were unapologetic about that. They were like, yeah, you have to beat the first game in order to be able to play the second one, because you want to take your party and otherwise you have no chance. So,
right.
So yeah, I think it was less of the creators saying, we want to punish players, and more the creators of Dragon Quest II saying, this is what RPGs are supposed to be like. They are supposed to be just absolutely nasty, you know, deeply destructive games where, yes, you might encounter an enemy group late in the game that wipes out your entire party in a single move. That just happens sometimes.
Friggin' bomb crags.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, I would say, is one of the most brutal RPGs at the start. It is, as I recall, it was one of the first RPGs I ever played that gave you the poison status. And that was, you could get poisoned by early enemies very, very early on in your first major sort of quest, which is to find the Prince of Middenhall. And that's basically, every time you take a step when you're poisoned, you lose HP and you can die. And if you want antidote herbs, of course, need to have a few on hand, and they cost a lot of money. And so you're using that money instead of buying upgrades for your armor and your weapons. And it's a real process.
And you only have so many inventory slots too.
Yeah, that's right. Oof.
Yeah, so we should talk about what Dragon Quest II did that was admirable, though, because it wasn't mm-hmm. all just, you know, brutality and
pain.
No,
absolutely not.
Like, these things came, I think, out of the desire to make, you know, as we said before, like a big, proper RPG that was more than just one dude killing one monster at a time.
Right.
So, Dragon Quest II was a very quick follow-up to the original Dragon Quest. Dragon Quest I came out in May of 1986 in Japan, and Dragon Quest II was actually slated for release in December of 1986. That was like, what, that's like 7 months?
That's crazy.
Very little time. They ended up delaying it for a couple of months because they kind of got in over their heads and were like, oh, this game actually is not beatable. So they revised it, and it ended up shipping a couple of months late. But still, that's 9 months after the original came out.
It's a baby.
Yeah, exactly. so that's a really ambitious cycle. And like you said, the game is four times bigger than the original Dragon Quest. They use a larger ROM.
Mm-hmm.
And they also made not just the quest bigger, but the experience bigger. This was no longer just a single protagonist fighting enemies one-on-one. Now you built a party over the course of the game, three characters, and you would fight groups of enemies, not just one enemy, mm-hmm. but, you know, sometimes up to like six enemies.
Oh, yes. And you had certain enemies that could call in reinforcements, like the army ant, I think, would call in sometimes dozens of reinforcements before you could finally kill them all.
Those slugs really do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
the jellyfish.
Slugs.
Yeah, there's a lot of enemies in Dragon Quest that do that, and it's actually, you know, in the more recent Dragon Quest, it's something I enjoy because you don't feel like you're always on the brink of losing. It just kind of keeps battles dynamic and makes you say, like, who do I prioritize? Do I go mm-hmm. after the really dangerous enemies who hit hard and have high hit points? Or do I go after the little guy over here who's not really going to do that much to me, but he's just going to keep calling other guys in and it's going to drag out the battle? So yeah, it's one of the things that this, yeah, it's one of those – definitely. But it's one of the things that I think is kind of a trademark of the series. And, you know, there are a lot of trademarks that started here. But, you know, you do have the team of characters, and in this case, you know, this predates Dragon Quest III, so the character roles don't really line up exactly with sort of what we think of as modern Dragon Quest roles. But, you know, even here you do see the way the series has a tendency to kind of assign skills like magic spells very arbitrarily and divide them up to different characters. So yeah, Nadia, why don't you talk about the characters that you acquire and sort of like the what they're like and so forth, if you don't mind.
Well, I think I don't mind at all. Thank you very much. the first character you acquire is actually the prince of a kingdom, and I always thought that was an interesting sort of story you follow. You are a prince of a kingdom, a descendant of Erdrick from the Dragon Quest lore, and when you hear about how your cousin's castle in Moonbrook has been razed to the ground, oh no, enemies are back, we have to do something about this, you're sent out to find your cousins and defeat, I think his name is Hargon, the evil bringer person. And there's a really interesting, cute little prologue at the start of the game when you start a new game that shows you what's going on. And it's very, very old English and very fun.
Yeah, I believe. Oh, I was going to say that. I believe they added that for the American version. That was not.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah. Just like in Dragon Warrior 3, they added that intro with the hero's father fighting the dragon.
That intro was badass as hell.
Yep. Yeah. They did do a lot of tweaking for the U.S. versions, I guess, because they had bigger ROMs available. And they felt like, you know, we need to lure the players in. They kind of. Every American Dragon Warrior game was a little better than the Dragon Quest version that had preceded it. But, you know, there was like a 3 years time difference. So they had time to go in and do some
tweaks. They did try hard.
The prologue is something added for the U.S. version.
Okay, I didn't know. So there you go. I learned something today. But you start as the prince, who is more of a tank character. He's got the proficiency with the sword. I don't recall if he had any magic at all. But if he did, it was quite minimal.
He's the only, I think the only Dragon Quest protagonist, like hero character, who does not have any magic spells whatsoever.
That is bizarre.
Right, right.
He is strictly just there as a damage sponge.
He is definitely a damage sponge because you find your cousin next in line who is kind of a mix of the two. He's okay with a sword and he has some decent magic. I think he has some healing magic.
Yeah, he's kind of what you would see as like a priest class character in later Dragon Quest, where he's not super fragile like a wizard type character. He does have some proficiency, but he can't equip the best armor. He can't equip the best sword, and he can't use the best magic. So it's like a sort of jack of all trades, master of none character.
Yeah, and the third character that is the glass cannon is your female cousin who you actually have to find her because she was turned into a dog by the bad guy. Oh, I was just going to say, that was actually one of my first, that was a really proud moment for me because I was quite young when I played Dragon Quest II and quite stupid. And I figured out that this character was this dog that was following around. I'm like, oh, she must be the cousin that was turned into a dog, because when you go to the castle of Moonbrook, you can talk to her, the ghost of her father, who says, you know, talks about her fate. So I actually figured out, okay, I have to find this mirror that turned her back into an actual person. And yay, I did it. And then she becomes your magic slinger, your black magic slinger. She has a lot of powerful spells.
Yeah, I really love that she's turned into a dog. It's a very whimsical Dragon Quest thing. And also, this is going to sound weird, but in the Wii game Fortune Street, so that is the like weird Japanese Monopoly made by who? Is it Chunsoft that makes that?
I don't actually remember who develops it. But it's, you know, it's like definitely an Enix tradition, Itadaki
right.
Street. That's been like a series of theirs for a long time.
So the Wii one came here. It's not very good, by the way. It's not great. But it has Dragon Quest characters and it has Mario characters in it. And the Princess of Moonbrook is in the game. And all of her dialogue is basically dog puns. And when I was playing it, I was just like, I am the only one who gets this. I am like one of five people who understands why this female character is talking inexplicably like a dog and using all dog puns. There's no explanation in the game. You just have to know that is her origin in Dragon Quest II. She was a dog, or she was turned into a dog. So just something fun in that game.
Wow. I love Dragon Quest localization. It's just off the wall.
Yeah, I mentioned that the protagonist, the hero character, the prince of what is he? Middenhall?
Is it Canuck?
Are you talking about the first guy you recruit or
your main character? The prince.
Oh.
Okay, so the prince of Middenhall is a damage sponge, but he kind of has to be because when you first encounter the prince of Canuck and the princess of Moonbrook, they both start out at level one, and by that point, your characters have already risen in levels. And there's no real easy way to bootstrap these other characters to get up to your level. So they are always going to be way behind you unless you deliberately go out and kill the hero and fight a bunch of combats with these two fragile characters to bring their levels up, which I guess is a thing you could do, but it seems extremely not fun. So,
yeah.
So throughout the game, you're going to have this one guy who's like physically very durable, kind of standing in front of these two characters who are going to die if you look at them funny.
Yeah, I mean, usually, well, this is not a four-character party, but usually in this kind of a setup, you're given two magic-using characters, one normally a healer, and then an additional character who is also a physical fighter. But they don't have that fourth character that would make this game much more playable. Mm-hmm. It is these two characters you play with, they die all the time. And that means going all the way, leaving a dungeon, going all the way back to where you started. It's very frustrating. I had a lot of problems in this game, and it's probably the one I played the most outside of Dragon Quest VII, just because I had this as a kid, and it was just kind of poking at it every day to figure out how far I could get without just being obliterated.
Wow, did you actually have the game, a copy of it?
I did, yeah. Like I think it was the whatever Christmas Dragon Warrior III came out. I wanted that for Christmas, but my parents couldn't find it anywhere, so I got Dragon Quest II or Dragon Warrior II, and it was a lot of fun, but man, it just kicked my ass, and I never finished the NES version.
Mm-hmm. I can understand why. I think the later versions were a little bit more balanced, but no, the NES version was pretty brutal.
Yeah, just a sort of lack of guidance because this game has a ship in it and ocean travel. And at a certain point in the game, it's just basically like find the seven things across the entire world. You're sort of just Dragon Quest One is fairly linear, but Dragon Quest Two, it's sort of just like, well, figure it out. Once you have a ship, you figure it out. And there's ship travel. There's whirlpool travel. There's just – it's easy to not know where you are or what to do next. And there's lots of like weird little puzzles as to how to get the seven things or the six things. I forget exactly what they are.
Yeah,
I think they're called Crests of Rubus or something like that.
Yeah, the Crests.
Rubus being the deity who was introduced in this game. I think we didn't have a good kind of god character until that point.
Yeah, who is there's a real Dracula on the box art. Is that the main villain of this game?
I think that's Hargoth, and then he's trying to summon Malroth. Hargon trying to summon Malroth.
He's not the most memorable. The most memorable villains in the series.
I know we mentioned this on that recording from as of this recording months ago, but at this point in his life, Toriyama, the artist, was way putting universal monsters in Dragon Ball. And that's why I love just seeing Dracula on the cover of this because it really puts it in time as to when like Frankenstein was in the Dragon Ball manga, like a version of Frankenstein.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and you know the American box art for this is it's not a recreation of the Japanese box art, but it takes all the Japanese character designs. It takes Akira Toriyama's designs and is like, okay, but what if these characters showed up on the cover of a novel that you buy at a convenience store, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
a sort
I love
of
that. I love
cheesy
that sort
fantasy
of
novel. So, yeah. Of course, you know, Princess of Moonbrook is wearing a very short frock that has her bosom exposed partway. And
yes.
The Prince of Kanak, who is like this kind of floppy-haired teenager in Toriyama's art, is now the, like this super beefy dude with long surfer hair. You know, kind of Thor-looking. Yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah, on the Japanese box art, I'm not sure if it's translated via the sprites that well, but the both male characters have goggles too. They both are wearing goggles.
Yes.
So that could have been those a Toriyama fixation as well during this time period.
Yeah, huh.
Yeah, I always love that, the fact that not just with Dragon Quest II, but Dragon Quest III and I think IV as well, if you look at the box art, if you look at the instruction manual art as well, they actually take Toriyama's actual drawings from the original instruction book and recreate them with those beefy-ass sort of American characters. And I love how they keep certain traits. Like, you always see the Sword of Loto there the way it should be. The Zenithian sword shows up in Dragon Quest, Dragon Warrior IV the way it should be. And I just love that sort of thing. I didn't appreciate those boxes until I grew up.
Yeah, the addition of the extra characters does change up the dynamic of the game. And this is actually why I never played Dragon Warrior 2 back in the day, because I really liked Dragon Quest, Dragon Warrior 1. And then when the sequel came out, I was like, wait, you have to deal with three characters at once? I know I've mentioned this before in the show, but the idea that I was going to have to like split up my resources between three characters and manage three characters, I thought that just doesn't seem fun to me. Of course, that's, you know, like that's dumb. I didn't know, but I
– It was a new idea for NES players though.
Yeah, it really
exactly.
was.
Exactly, it was.
Final Fantasy I hadn't played quite yet at that point. And then once Final Fantasy came out, I was like, oh, I don't want to go back to Dragon Warrior. It's so much more primitive.
No.
I'm sorry. I was one of those people for a long time. I got over it. I'm better. Rocket Slime showed me the light. So everything is good now. But yeah, it really does change up the dynamic of the game, because you do have to manage resources. You do have to consider, like, you know, how am I going to act in battle? There's a certain amount of automation that happens in the Dragon Quest games when you're dealing with groups of enemies. And even now, like in Dragon Quest XI, enemies show up and they appear in groups. So you might have like three different kinds of enemies, but if there are multiples of one enemy type, they are treated as a group, and there's a certain amount of sort of AI a certain amount of artificial intelligence that the computer uses to determine like which of those characters within the group will you attack. And the computer always kind of tilts things a little bit in your favor. You're always going to attack the enemy that's most advantageous. So there's like two enemies in a group, and one of them has very like a lot of hit points remaining. The other is very weak. The computer is going to make your character attack the enemy who can be taken out with a single hit if there is one of those available. And I think that started here. I'd have to go back and check again. But, you know, as much as the game is very unfair and cruel in a lot of respects, there is still this kind of sense of like the computer is working a little bit in your favor.
It's
saying
trying,
like
yeah.
your characters aren't completely, you know, total bozos in combat. They can exercise their own tactics to a degree. And I think you see that most in Dragon Warrior 4 where you're once you get to the final chapter, which is the majority of the game, and you play as the hero, your companions are computer controlled. And that's something they changed in later remakes
yes,
and stuff.
But. That's right.
Is there auto battle in this Dragon Quest for your team?
Think so.
I think they added it in the Super Famicom and mobile versions, but I guess it's not in this one. That's something that they would eventually put onto the games.
I don't know. I did not think to look for that.
No, I don't think it was there. I think it might have started. I know it definitely wasn't in 3, so I think it started in 4.
Yeah, I mean, I used to consider that a sacrilege. Like, no, I want to choose all my options. But now, as an adult, I love any RPG with an auto button.
Oh, me too. At first, I was the same way. I was like, there is no way I am not controlling every aspect of my party. And I'm like, oh, yep, you want to go for it? Be my guest. Oh, you want to use a stick to attack that dragon? Go for it, man.
It's better than hammering A. You can just stare off into the distance until the battle music is over.
Yeah, indeed. I get frustrated with the auto battle characters when they unleash really devastating attacks that they don't need to. It's like, hey, we're just fighting some slimes. You don't need to kaboom them all. That was a waste of magic
sure
points.
You do. I always have to set the thing to not healing me every time I lose a hit point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I set all of mine to, in the later games, to never heal. Like, I'll do the healing. It's fine. Don't do that, please.
Thank you.
So Nadia, you mentioned that Dragon Quest II, Dragon Warrior II, whatever you want to call it, is set after the original Dragon Quest, and that you're descendants of the descendant of Erdrick.
Yes, yes, you are.
So it's like basically the hero Dragon Quest I. Like he had a lot of kids, and they scattered to the three corners of the earth, or something like that.
A descendant of a descendant is still a descendant.
That's true. Well, yes, I was trying to get the point across that you're the descendant of the character in the first game, but he's also just referred to as the descendant of Erdrick.
So like rival begat.
The descendant, yeah, begat. Yeah, exactly. This is like totally the book of what the heck is it? Deuteronomy. So
Erdrick begets
exactly.
What's the name? Does this character have a name in this game?
No, the heroes never have a game.
Okay.
No, the heroes doesn't have a name.
Not even actually 11?
Nope, they're always named Hero.
Okay.
If you look on the back of the boxes, the character's name is always the number of the Dragon Quest game written out. So nine in INE for Dragon Quest IX. And apparently Yuji Horii always names his character George.
Huh. So
or Georgie.
George, the great savior.
Yeah, I asked him that when I met him. I was like, so what do you call your character? And he was like, George. It's always George.
Hmm.
So now you know.
Well, there is St. George, the Dragon Slayer.
I don't know if that's it.
Huh.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But what I think is interesting is that, yes, your party members all descend from the original game's hero, but they're not the only descendants here. You also run into the descendant of the Dragon Lord,
who is like... That's right.
Yeah, like, oh, sorry about Grandpa. He's like living in hiding, you know. It's like, you know, after World War II, all the Hitlers changed their names so they wouldn't show up in the phone book. I think it's kind of the same thing. He's like, yeah, let me help you out on this quest. I feel really bad about Grandpa.
You actually – that's right. When you go to Alefgard, you can, of course, see Charlotte Castle. You're like, oh, I'm going to get in trouble. Go in there. And it's the same setup. It's a lot of fun. And you go in there, and the grandson of the Dragon Lord is just sitting there chilling on the throne, and you talk to him, and he says, oh, hi, I'm the grandson of the Dragon Lord. And he tells you, he's actually the one who tells you about Rubus and the crests, if I'm not mistaken. So he really gives you a hand up.
That was very nice of him. So it's a fun little kind of inversion. And you did see this a lot, you know, return in an NES sequel to the stomping grounds of the first game. Castlevania had it, Castlevania 2. Zelda 2 had it. I feel like there were a couple of other games, but Kirby's Adventure even, you know, you return to Kirby's Dream Land and it's black and white.
Oh, that's so cool.
So this is kind of that grand tradition of like, hey, we're bigger and better now, so let's go back and see how humble we used to be. But it in this case, it's actually very important.
Mm-hmm,
I guess in Zelda 2, it's also very important because that's where you get – there's some sort of really critical power-up. I can't remember what it is. Oh, maybe the hammer? I think you go into like a cavern and you get the hammer, I think, and then that lets you take shortcuts throughout the world. So
and the big thing in Dragon Quest III is that you discover the world of Dragon Quest I, and that's when it's revealed that this is a prequel, which is one of the coolest reveals in a game, period.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's actually – that Alefgard is more to scale with the original, which is really amazing.
I will say we're not building a case that you should play this game, but so original release was on the NES. If you want to play it, I think the mobile version is bad. It took them a while to figure out how to make these mobile versions good. I think maybe 3 is probably the first one that's even approaching good, and then 4, 5, 6 are the DS games. Just put on a phone and those are fine. But I will say go search out the ROM for the 1 and 2 remakes for the Super Famicom.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is the ideal version of 2, and that is where I actually finished the game because they made the difficulty more fair, and they also added some like quality of life features. The Game Boy Color one is great, but it's really hard. Like the text boxes are just way too big.
It's
hard to play.
Yeah. So my thought is, if you want to play, you know, like legitimately the Super Famicom remakes, those are what they used to create the Game Boy Color versions, and that did come to the U.S. So you can buy Dragon Warrior 1 and 2 for Game Boy Color. But the screen scaling is really I find even the original Dragon Warrior is really tough, not just because of the text boxes, but just because when you're in the map and you're traveling around, you have such a cramped view of the environment that it makes exploration a lot more tedious.
Yeah.
That's the one downside, really.
I will say that it is fan-translated, by the way. It's been fan-translated forever, and you're not hurting anybody. So if you really want to play it
– I mean, I've got those on like fan-burned cartridges, that and Dragon Quest III.
The Dragon Quest III remake is also great for Super Famicom.
Very good.
It's so pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually rediscovered Dragon Quest through the Game Boy Color when those remakes came out, and Dragon Quest III for Game Boy Color. That was also, I know it wasn't the ideal port compared to the SNES ones, but it was as good as we had at the time, and it was definitely better than nothing, that's for sure, except for that terrible box art for Dragon Quest I and II. That was just sad.
Yeah, I that's how I really got back into Dragon Quest, was through the Game Boy remix that came out in the early 2000s.
It was 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really got back into the series then.
You were ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it was Rocket Slime that made me say, wait a minute, this is good and fun and happy, and I love this.
That's right.
I guess if I tried to get back in with Dragon Quest II, I would have been like, oh, this is mean and evil and it hates me and I hate it.
This is why I hated it.
Exactly. But yeah, there are some things I like about Dragon Warrior II. And I think, you know, if you wanted to play this game on an emulator and save scum some of the later sections, that might be the way to go because, I mentioned the enemies that can take you out in a single move. It's the kamikaze rocks, right?
The kamikaze, the bomb craigs. They will take you out. They're actually very unnerving enemies because they will skip a turn either or destroy you. And when they skip a turn, they grin at you. So you don't know what's coming.
Oh, yeah. It's like it actually says out of the text boxes. That's one of my favorite things about the Dragon Quest games is that they still, you know, even with like the flashy combat of Dragon Quest 9 and 11 and 8 and so forth, like they still give you text boxes to tell you what's happening in combat. And they have fun with that. It's like enemies will like preen or they'll stare off into space or they'll get dazed or, you know, when one of your characters gets ensorcelled or something, there'll be fun descriptions of what's happening there. And so, yeah, I think the bomb crags are a good example of them using that text display to do something that you couldn't do in something like Final Fantasy where you don't have that information.
Dragon Quest was always just very kind of never took itself as seriously.
Right. Yeah. It has that the Akira Toriyama cartoonish whimsy to it. And that makes a big difference.
I could be misremembering this because I haven't played this in a while, but my memories of this game as a kid are there are so many towers in this game and they're so confusing and the enemies are just the worst in those towers. So I feel like that is the real endurance test of Dragon Quest, the many towers you have to go through. And that was a new feature. I believe the only dungeons in the first game were caves. Until you got to the Dragon Lord's Castle. Yeah.
And this was, I think this might have been the game, it was either this or three, where you had to jump off the tower wearing a certain item to get across a river. And it's just so obscure, obtuse. I don't know how I figured it out. I think maybe someone tells you, but
yeah, I mean,
it's just so weird.
At the very least, there is a nice like little parachute for you in terms of if you're really getting pounded in a tower, you can just jump out of it and then just be back on the map and be fine.
No problem.
I like that feature. I used it a lot.
Yeah, it's a good way to level up your characters to just kind of take the emergency exit up in the sky. One thing I will say about Dragon Warrior 2, it has one of my favorite soundtracks of the Dragon Quest series.
Yeah,
it was
actually
just very ambitious for its time.
It's probably burned into my head because I played this so much, but whenever I'm still plugging through Dragon Quest Builders, by the way. It's a very long game, but I love when those songs pop up in that game.
I love the remixes.
Yeah,
I love
they're
that
great.
Game so much.
Yeah, I feel like at this point, Sugiyama doesn't really write new music. It's just like every game is just remixes of the old music. I mean, Dragon Quest XI all the way through, it's just remixes all the way to the end.
The downside of that is when those are remixed and put in things like Builders and Dragon Quest Heroes, you realize, like, oh, this is a 45-second loop, and that's all you're getting. My parrot loves it because it's very repetitive, but I eventually have to
Does
put a podcast
start
on.
Doing like a dance when you play Dragon Quest?
He starts whistling along to it, which is cute.
Oh,
so
that's amazing.
Parrots love Sugiyama.
Please record that and show it to me.
So as much as we've been kind of bagging on Dragon Quest Two, I do want to say, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you don't get Dragon Quest III without Dragon Quest II. This was where they were figuring out a lot of things. Dragon Quest I was basically just like them saying, let's make something that's kind of like an RPG. This was them saying, let's make an actual RPG. Dragon Quest III was them saying, let's make an RPG that is good and fun and has its own really distinct personality and doesn't make people feel sad for playing it.
And also the biggest friggin' RPG you've ever seen in your life. That game is, I mean, especially for mm-hmm. the time, it's huge. I'm still impressed by how big Dragon Quest III is, but
so am I.
I mean, that's really why I love III because it's so huge, but II was my first like major Dragon Quest experience, and playing that game as a kid and just not knowing what to do and poking around, I just felt like it could go on forever. I felt the enormity of the world, especially when just wandering around aimlessly with that ship and just stumbling upon new islands and wondering what's on them and then being afraid.
Yeah, they kind of throw that to you at the very start of the game, actually, when you can visit your very first travel gate in the castle. And it, when you take it, you end up on an island. You can't do anything, but you can see there's a town on an island on the other side. And you're like, wow, okay, I really want to get there. I thought that was a really interesting way to get you hyped up for exploring.
Was this the first RPG to give you a final boss that isn't the final boss? Because you get to Hargon and you defeat him, and he's like, oh, I'm sacrificing my sad corpse to bring back Mal'Roth. Mm. And then you have to fight the actual final boss, which is now just like, oh, yeah, every RPG does that.
Yeah, I mean, Dragon Quest especially, they just kept doing that. Mm-hmm. There's always like
still do that.
There's always like some dipshit wizard guy, and then you fight whatever he summons or gets absorbed by or whatever after that.
Yeah, I feel like this was, that was a fresh idea. I don't know if there were any computer RPGs that did that at the time. I have not actually like beaten Ultima 3, but you know, I feel like it was a pretty fresh and interesting idea. The concept that you've been going after this guy all this time, and he's not actually the bad guy.
Final Fantasy would really
get into doing that too, but.
Yeah, so you kind of have that little bait and switch, which is a nice twist when you're a kid playing this for the first time. Like, wow.
This is also this game sets up a lot of traditional things in Dragon Quest that weren't in the first game. And one of them is, this may sound minor, but it's pretty interesting, just the variety of keys that you have, which is now a Dragon Quest staple, where it's like there are certain like degrees of keys. And once you are at the end of the game, you get the key that opens everything. You can just go back through the world and unlock
princess's
every door.
The best spell is just the ability to open up a keyhole.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she has totally forgot.
Like, that's her best spell. Is
it any keyhole?
Finally, you can open up any door.
Because there are certain like – the prison doors are important because there are certain quest things you need behind prison doors. There's like silver keys, prison keys. It really established that system. I believe in Dragon Quest I, you just bought keys and used used them as items instead of just finding an all-purpose key for this type of lock.
Right. That's like a level 25 spell for her, so she has to get really far into the game to get that. So it's kind of like an in-game.
Finding the keys was one of the big things for me, because I remember seeing all these doors that were locked and I couldn't access them. It was driving me crazy, and I'm like, oh, where's the gold key? Where's the gold key? And then you finally find it and you just feel so accomplished. And I think the other keys come quickly after that.
Yeah, and I think from this point on, they really do a good job of just in the first castle that you start in or the first town that you start in, there are just all of these doors that you can't get beyond just to make you think, God, I really need to come back here. And there's usually powerful stuff in the very first place you start that you just can't reach until much later in the game.
It's like a Metroidvania or something.
Oh my God, oh my God. You're below. Is Dragon Quest II the first
Dragon
Metroidvania?
Quest, that's right.
You're first.
So anyway, Dragon Quest II is an important game, but one that's really difficult to revisit. I would like to see them remake it.
I'd like that.
To put together the original trilogy in a package for Switch or PS4 or something with some quality of life improvements. That'd be nice.
Yeah, I get the impression that Dragon Quest Builders 2 is based on Dragon Quest 2.
It is, yes.
Yes, so that's kind of a remake, but actually, well, given how much I loved what they did with the Dragon Quest 1 story in Dragon Quest Builders, I'm curious to see if they're going to do a Dragon Quest 2.
Oh, yeah, do we know any more details about that? I believe it's out in Japan. I'm just curious.
It's
as
not
to,
out yet.
Oh, really?
Not
okay. I thought it was, boy.
But it has been announced for US release on Switch, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to build off Dragon Quest II story, because the first game, you have the choice at the end, but you don't really have that in Dragon Quest II. So you don't have that, you know, the timeline split thing. Which link are you now? It'll be interesting to see exactly what they do with that.
I hope the boss fights are better in that game, though. That's the biggest bummer about Builders is the game is not built for boss fights, so they have to. It's very stupid. I don't think it's stupid,
but it is frustrating that you fight like a golem and all your hard work is destroyed by that bastard. Oh my god!
It's
hours
like
of my life.
You spend about 15 hours building a town, and then the boss fight is designed to destroy everything you did and.
It does create like a really profound sense of loss when, you know, more so than like this boss is an actual threat. It's destroying all the things you've done. Like it's frustrating, but also kind of good. Like it actually makes the bosses really intense and really threatening. I don't know.
Yeah.
I like it.
I agree with you. It does make you really feel like you're fighting for something. And when you replay the game like I did on the Switch, you're like, all right, I'm building these triple thick walls all over this damn city, which is what you're supposed to do.
I know where the golem's coming from. I'm going to do everything in my power to destroy him. All right. So final thoughts on Dragon Quest II.
Well, it's I will say I rented it. This is the first time I played it. I rented it and I brought it home and I played a whole bunch of it and I saved. And then my battery died because apparently I guess someone had rented it before me and save scummed or something. But so that was the thing that happened. I would constantly get up to a certain point in the game. Everything would be erased. I'd try again and again and again. It was like that stone being rolled up the hill with the Greek myth.
That's terrible.
Yeah. I still went at it, though.
So you say it's the – sorry, Nadia.
Oh, I was just saying that was – so there you go. I was quite dedicated to the game. I kept on replaying it and replaying it for as long as my rental period allowed.
So we're still on the same page that it is the worst Dragon Quest game?
The worst numbered Dragon Quest game.
The worst numbered one, yeah. I feel like how long is this game? It's hard to put that into – I mean there's no timer. Is it like a 15-hour RPG, a 20-hour RPG?
I think you describe a game like this in percentage of your life.
Mm, okay.
Exactly. I'd say like 3% of your life.
I would say it's probably pretty digestible if you play that Super Famicom version or the Game Boy Color version and you cheat a little bit if you want to just have the experience. And don't feel bad because this game is not balanced very well and is not designed super great. If you want to just have the whole Dragon Quest experience, play all of them, I feel like it's a game from 1987. 86?
Yep, 87.
So,
oh my gosh.
Think about that and think about how long a game from 1987 is, and it's not the longest game you'll ever play, but it is interesting from a historical standpoint just to see how they were really building off of a very, very, very simple experience and not really knowing what to do until the third game.
Yeah, I would say if you're any sort of a Dragon Quest fan, it's just a really interesting damaged bit of connective tissue to visit. But I would say take the trip anyway.
Yep. All right, so that wraps it up for this look at Dragon Quest 1 and 2, this retrospective. This, of course, was a tie-in with the RPG history feature I've been working on for US Gamer. So you can check that out. There's fresh information from Yuji Horii in the Dragon Quest entry there. So usgamer.net, it's where you go to read stuff. But you also go to retronauts.com, where Bob and I post stuff on the regular. And, of course, you can get the podcast there at retronauts.com as well as on iTunes, the Podcast One Network, and so on and so forth. And Retronauts is supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. That's how we pay our bills and buy our food and so forth. So please support us. $3 a month gets you early access to podcasts. More than that, you get bonus stuff like T-shirts and books and other cool things.
The new T-shirts are great, by the way.
Yes. Cassie Kelly designed those. They're so great.
I want one.
I would like one too. I'm still waiting on the shipment to come in.
Do I have to support us for that?
You do, yes.
Oh, man.
You've been holding out, Bob. Anyway, that's the Retronauts thing. Follow us, like us, support us, love us, or just listen to us and tell your friends about it. That's okay too. As for myself, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on the internet at various places where Jeremy Parrish appears, such as Twitter, where I'm GameSpite, even though I'm not actually that spiteful anymore. I'm a nice guy.
You're very mellow.
I'm full of the mellow Dragon Quest. And there's Bob over there. Bob, tell us about
yourself. Hey, everybody. I am Bob Mackey. You know me. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. I have a bunch of other podcasts via the Talking Simpsons podcast network. If you go to patreon.com/Talking Simpsons, you can find out how to support me there. That's where I get most of my income. And we do a lot of work there, like the podcast Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. And What a Cartoon, where we look at a different cartoon from a different series every week. And we have tons of bonus exclusive series on the Patreon, like Talking Critic and Talking Futurama. And all of our exclusive stuff will live there. There's dozens and dozens of bonus podcasts there if you sign up at the $5 level. So go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons to find out more. And those two podcasts, Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon, are both free. So if you just want to listen to them and see what they're all about, you can find those on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And Nadia, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, sure. Why not? My name's, of course, Nadia Oxford. I'm at usgamer.net is where most of my writing is these days. And you should also listen to the Acts of the Blood God podcast, which is by Kat Bailey and myself. And we talk all about RPGs, including Dragon Quest. That goes up every Monday, I believe. And, of course, you can subscribe on wherever podcasts are sold, as Kat typically says at the end of the show.
All right. And I guess that will be it for this episode. So check back in a week and there will be another episode. It's a crazy thing we do. It's called Publishing Weekly. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about Dragon Quest III next time I can get John Riccardi corralled into a studio. I promise we would talk about Dragon Quest III with him. So whenever that is, we'll talk about the next game in the series. And hopefully we'll have Nadia back on the show before that.
So yes, please.
Thanks, Nadia, for dropping by. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we're gone. Goodbye.